Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's probably a coin toss for the industry most disliked in the healthcare debate, insurance companies or pharmaceutical makers. It's also true, though, that to get anything done in Washington, you have to make deals with everybody. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents the Scratchpad blog. Host Scott Jagow keeps you updated on business news worth talking about. Available daily at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It is the 6th of August today. You start any serious policy discussion in Washington knowing you'll have to give a little to get a little. And quite frequently, giving a little to the side of the debate that's not all that popular. Back in June, as healthcare was just clawing its way into the headlines, the White House announced a deal with the pharmaceutical industry. It's designed to cut prescription drug costs for seniors by $80 billion over the next 10 years. At the time, the president called it a significant breakthrough on the road to healthcare reform. But as Tamara Keith reminds us now from Washington, the devil is always in the details.
As part of the deal, the pharmaceutical industry agreed to help seniors by giving them discounts on drugs not covered by Medicare. There would be savings to the government, too, all adding up to $80 billion. What's creating a stir now is that the White House apparently agreed to protect the industry from congressional efforts to extract more savings.
Really, somebody would be under a delusion to think pharma was giving up $80 billion out of the goodness of its collective heart.
Melanie Sloan is executive director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. She says this is how deals are done.
Obviously, the White House has been talking to not just pharma, but everybody across the board in healthcare, the insurers, the doctors, the unions. There's just no one who hasn't been included, and everybody's going to have to give something for there to be any kind of deal in the end.
The Obama administration got something out of the deal, too, says Henry Aaron of the Brookings Institution. It got buy-in from a big player.
The drug industry was on their side of the table, the administration side of the table on health reform, and that was a very important political advance in the administration's effort.
But the Obama administration isn't the only one at the table. Some members of Congress and interest groups like the AARP don't think the pharmaceutical industry's $80 billion is enough. They want the government to be able to negotiate drug prices and import cheaper medications from Canada. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Speaking of the healthcare debate, things have gotten downright confrontational in some parts of the country. You've probably heard of congressional town hall meetings being disrupted by protesters recently. Mobs shouted down a congressman in Texas. They hung another in effigy in Maryland, and they booed senators from coast to coast. Even in the age of the internet, though, orchestrated mass action doesn't come cheap. So we asked Marketplace's Steve Henn to look into who's paying.
Silent no more!
These protests started almost simultaneously.
Silent no more!
All across the country last weekend, men and women holding signs and chanting greeted members of Congress and senators at town halls in at least a dozen states. As the meetings began, the protesters spread out and shouted angry questions. Opponents of the health care overhaul called it a grassroots uprising, and right-wing activists like Grover Norquist are passing out talking points to support it. But many Democrats believe the demonstrations themselves are being organized by pros. And if they are, the public may never know who's paying for them. Laws require paid lobbyists to disclose the companies that hire them. But
at the moment, for better or worse, the Lobbying Disclosure Act does not cover attempts to create demonstrations.
Tara Malloy at the Campaign Legal Center says a huge part of Washington's influence industry operates out of sight. Firms can fly operatives across the country and even pay protesters directly, and they're not required to tell Congress or the public what they're up to.
Really, it can be the biggest industries hiring the most sophisticated firms out there, and the public will know very, very little about these efforts. And indeed, these type of flash mobs or these type of protests, they can have a huge impact on the course of legislation.
Some lobbying experts estimate that roughly three-quarters of the industry is made up of unregistered lobbyists who never disclose their clients, their causes, or how much they make. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn, for Marketplace.
The uber-popular Cash for Clunkers program is set to get another $2 billion from the Senate before lawmakers go home for a month. The aim is to get gas guzzlers off the road and at the same time give the economy a boost with new car sales. Dealers love it. Car makers love it. Car buyers certainly love it. How environmental is it, though? Sam Eaton has that story from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Being green often comes down to this: reduce, reuse, recycle, in that particular order. But Cash for Clunkers skips all the way down to the last step. It requires gas guzzlers, engines and all, to be shredded into scrap metal for recycling, even if the engines are good enough to be reused. And that has scrapyard owners like Rick Morrow questioning just how green the program is. He's the owner of M&M Auto Parts in Stafford, Virginia. He says reusing car parts is far better for the environment than recycling them, and he's built his business on that model.
Long before green was popular, I mean, this kind of operation, even though, you know, a lot of people said, oh, junkyard, but they were actually making use of what the component was built for in the first place.
And he's got a point. It takes a lot of energy to melt metal from old cars and make new ones. But David Friedman with the Union of Concerned Scientists says in the case of Cash for Clunkers, scrapping the cars comes out ahead.
For a gas guzzler, you're talking 90 to 95% of the energy that's used over its life comes from actually burning fuel, and only 5 to 10% comes from making the vehicle.
So getting it off the road, he says, makes more sense environmentally, as long as the new car that's replacing it is more efficient. That's where Friedman says there's room for improvement. To qualify for the Cash for Clunkers program, the new car you buy only has to get 22 miles per gallon, still a guzzler by most standards. Friedman says the program is still worthwhile, but don't expect any meaningful reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. He says for that, you have to wait until 2016, when the new federal standards for fuel economy kick in. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street backed off their buying habits once more. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you happen to see the Sunday talk shows this past weekend, you saw a classic example of a favorite Washington political tactic, the trial balloon. Key members of the White House economic team seemed to suggest the president would be open to raising taxes to control the deficit. That would be politically challenging for the president, because back during the campaign, candidate Obama said, and frequently too, that he wouldn't raise taxes on people making up to $250,000 a year. The White House spent most of Monday trying to pop that trial balloon, but commentator Lawrence Haas says they ought to just own up to it.
Let me end the suspense. After the economy recovers, President Obama will raise taxes on middle-class Americans. He has to. He simply can't fulfill his no-tax pledge and govern effectively. Here's why. We are bleeding red ink like never before. We're running the largest budget deficits in our history, and our lenders, like China, may not keep buying our debt. They're already nervous that we'll just print more money to pay our bills. That will cause inflation to rise and their investments to shrink in value. At some point, our investors may go elsewhere. We would then have to raise our interest rates to entice other countries to lend to us. That would threaten our economic recovery, and that's something the president wants to avoid. We can't cut our deficit enough without raising taxes. What's mainly driving our deficit is the growth of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And Americans won't support big enough cuts in those programs alone to reduce the deficit. And we cannot raise taxes just on the rich to stem the red ink. There aren't enough rich people. Besides, forget the deficit for a minute. We can't even do the things we need to do, like provide health care for all Americans, without raising taxes on the middle class. That's why Congress has stalled on health reform. They don't want to raise taxes on middle-class Americans, but they may have to. Obama is learning a hard lesson. Don't make tax promises that you can't keep. It helps you get elected, but it makes it much harder to govern. Presidents Reagan, Clinton, and the first Bush all faced rising deficits and all raised taxes after promising not to. Obama will be no different. He'll raise taxes because, frankly, it's the right thing to do.
Lawrence Haas was the communications director for the White House Office of Management and Budget during the Clinton administration. You can send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has had a rough time of it lately. He's faced the same criticism officials here have about loose regulation of the financial system. He's had members of Parliament filing official expense reports for things like fixing the moats around their castles. And a poll out this week shows that two-thirds of the population is unhappy with the way he's handling the always sensitive issue of immigration. So the British government is about to make it harder to get into that country and tougher to become a citizen. From London, Christopher Worth reports.
If you want to feel how crowded Britain is, there's nowhere better than a busy train station like London's Liverpool Street station. Here, you really can believe that England recently overtook the Netherlands as Western Europe's most densely populated country. Thomas, who wouldn't give his last name, is an asylum seeker who sells flowers at a small kiosk on the station concourse.
Usually we have gerbera, we have chrysanthemums. Now is the time for peonies. All the flowers from all over the world.
People from every corner, too. Eastern Europeans working in finance or construction. People from the former colonies in Africa and Asia. Refugees, like Thomas, escaping war and poverty at home.
Yeah, I'm from Eritrea. Yeah, and, because of the fight, my family moved here. So that's why I'm here.
Thomas moved to London 9 years ago. He's about to apply for citizenship. It used to be almost automatic. Live here for 5 years, keep your nose clean, and you'd get the good news in the mail. But some Brits thought it was far too easy. Far-right parties increased their vote in recent elections, and now the government's decided to introduce tougher requirements, an Australian-style system where you get more points for relevant work experience, greater skills, and better education. Lynn Homer heads up the UK's border agency.
It is a system where we can move the bar up and down as the needs of the country dictate. So we can welcome the people that have something to offer to the UK, but we can adjust it so that we don't bluntly end up with more workforce than we've got jobs for.
Under the new system, foreigners seeking citizenship, residence visas, or temporary work visas would lose points for committing a crime or possibly even for taking part in protests. The system would allow the government to adjust the flow of immigration to the level of skill shortages in the UK.
I think at the moment the idea is very much to turn the tap off.
Tim Finch is with Britain's Institute for Public Policy Research. He says the UK has seen an influx of 1.4 million migrants since more Eastern European nations joined the European Union back in 2004. There's little the UK can do to curb EU migration. EU citizens are free to cross borders pretty much as they please. Finch says that's why Prime Minister Gordon Brown is being pressured to control immigration from outside the EU.
Many of the strongest opponents of migration now don't take an economic argument. So they don't say these people are taking our jobs or threatening our living standards, because they know there isn't any evidence for that. It's become very much about, do we want a population that's going from 60 to 70 to 80 million, as it's projected to do, and the sense that we don't want this to be some sort of humming Singapore or Hong Kong type place.
Finch sees different risks. He says tough new immigration controls may seem sensible, but stemming legal immigration may leave immigrants at the mercy of dangerous illegal traffickers. Also, the kind of highly educated, skilled foreigners who have poured into Britain's financial services industry in recent years may be put off coming here because a system that was once too easy will have become too tough. In London, this is Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Coming up, trying to modify an adjustable-rate mortgage.
Why would we agree to that? Honestly, we're still confused that we didn't read the whole thing. We really trusted her.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 24 points today, 0.25%, ended at 9,256. The NASDAQ dropped 19 points, 1%, closed at 1973. The S&P 500 shed 5 points, about 0.5%, wrapped up trading at 997. A less than rosy outlook from John Chambers. He's the CEO of Cisco Systems, weighed on things today. Chambers said business is improving, but it's too soon to call it a recovery. Still, Cisco shares rose more than 0.5%. Disappointing results from low-cost wireless provider Metro PCS also soured the mood. Second quarter earnings there fell by almost half. Shares hit a dead sell area and dropped nearly 30% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department lets us know what unemployment looked like in July. The Federal Reserve reports on consumer credit for June. And Eat Your Wheaties, Music Fest Lollapalooza kicks off tomorrow in Chicago. Bands play just about all day for 3 days. Large chains or spiked jewelry are prohibited. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp announced quarterly profits late yesterday afternoon. The world's biggest media conglomerate actually lost a couple of $100 million April through June, and that's worth mention, I suppose. But it's what Murdoch's planning to do to get profitable again that's really gotten people's attention. The guy who owns the Wall Street Journal and Fox News and papers from New York to London and Sydney said he's going to start charging for his online content. Stacey Kramer is the co-editor of paidcontent.org. Stacey, good to have you with us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Let me just talk logistics here for a second. Do you think Mr. Murdoch's going to slam all of his sites closed at once, or is he going to roll this out over time?
Well, the assumption there is that he's going to slam them all closed, and I don't think he's going to do that. I think he's not going to put up a fortress and say, no one can get in unless they pay. What I think we're talking about are a lot of gates.
So, in other words, over time, you'll have to pay more for whatever you want to see from the Murdoch empire.
You'll have to pay something for what you want to see, but it's not clear that you'd have to pay for everything the Murdoch empire provides in the way of news.
Yeah, because paying for, the Wall Street Journal, for instance, is one thing. Paying for, News of the World, I'd say is quite another.
I suggested today that some people might be willing to pay 10p not to see the page 3 or page 6 pictures.
Yes, 10 pence. Those would be the naked lady pictures. Yeah.
Yes. Which might make reading The Sun more enjoyable for some people.
Oh, that's right.
On the other hand, there are people who might pay a pound to see those pictures. What we don't know yet is what he's going to charge for and how it's going to be done. So the Wall Street Journal isn't completely pay access. A lot of the Wall Street Journal is available to you whether you're a subscriber or not. And if that's the model he's using, then I'm not expecting everything to be shut off. I'm expecting there to be a mix.
Isn't there a downside risk to this whole thing for him that advertisers are going to see the number of eyeballs on his sites in theory plummet because now you have to pay for it and he's not going to get the ad revenue? I mean, what is he risking by doing this?
Well, that's one reason why I don't believe it's going to go all pay, because that would be a very big hit on the advertising side. And one of the things they've been doing with the Wall Street Journal and with the Associated Properties from Dow Jones is calibrating very carefully how much traffic they can get to support significant advertising while at the same time keeping enough of that content valuable enough for people to pay for. That's the balancing act they have to run all the way across the news sites of the Murdoch empire. Charging isn't hard. Getting people
right.
to pay
right.
and making sure that you don't hurt your advertising business at the same time is what matters.
Is this, as the buzz has been today, the beginning of the end of free on the Internet?
No.
Boom, done. You just don't think it's going to stick?
It's not that it's going to stick or not. It's just that it's not the beginning of the end of free because it's never all been free to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And free, in some respects, is a myth that people hold on to. Professional media is paid in one way, shape, or form no matter what you do. It's paid through your attention. It's paid through your attention to advertisers. It's paid in a lot of different ways. If that attention doesn't make enough money to support what you're tuning into or reading or watching, then there has to be another way to do it.
And still nobody has been able to figure it out. I mean, that's the crux of this whole thing, isn't it?
Well, it is. Now, a lot of people think they have answers. A lot of people are trying. A lot of people are trying very hard to make this work. Micropayments is one way to do it. The Financial Times does a metered use payment plan.
The more you come, the more you pay.
That's right. The Wall Street Journal, for WallStreetJournal.com, I pay a flat fee. If I'm a subscriber to the print edition, I pay a smaller flat fee. there's a lot of different ways that people are trying to do this. You know, I think what we're going to enter into here is a very big experimental phase with News Corp and how they will handle this. And if you look at whatever they do at the beginning, shouldn't be viewed as something that even they expect to have be in place a year from then.
Stacey Kramer, she's the co-editor of paidcontent.org. Stacey, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, and let's see how it all goes.
Earlier this week, the Obama administration's foreclosure prevention program got its first report card, Making Home Affordable, the program is called. The grades were decidedly mixed. A lot of banks have been slow to help homeowners manage their monthly payments. There are a lot of reasons why that's so, but a big one brings us back to what got the economy into this mess in the first place, mortgage-backed securities. Karen Wise from the investigative newsroom ProPublica has our story.
The Making Home Affordable program is for homeowners who have trouble with their mortgage, but could probably keep up if their monthly payments were lower. The program gives banks incentives to bring down those monthly payments to about a third of a homeowner's income. But Barbara Harris and her husband haven't seen that relief. They live in a peaceful suburb of Atlanta. Their two-story home is filled with knickknacks and souvenirs, and it's all color-coordinated. I see a lot of pink. Who's the pink fan?
Me. I'm the pink lady.
The Harrises have lived here for nearly two decades. Both are retired from government jobs. Their problem started 5 years ago when carpenter bees attacked their home.
One side over here had eaten out. They hit down the whole side of the house.
So the Harrises decided to refinance their mortgage to pull out $21,000 in cash for the repairs. They called a mortgage broker who advertised in their church bulletin. The broker came back with an offer from Wells Fargo for a loan at just over 7.5%. What the broker didn't tell them was that the rate was adjustable.
Why would we agree to that? Honestly, we're still confused that we didn't read the whole thing. We really trusted her.
The retirees were shocked when the interest rate jumped to over 12%. Their payments went from an affordable $1,600 a month to $2,500.
As you can see, there have been lots of correspondence back and forth on this.
Steve Crum is the Harris' legal aid lawyer. For 2 years, long before the Making Home Affordable program, he's been trying to reduce their monthly payment. But finding somebody to take responsibility hasn't been easy. That's because their loan is wrapped up in one of those infamous mortgage-backed securities. And that makes things, shall we say, complicated. If Wells Fargo still owned the loan, there would only be two parties involved, the bank and the Harrises. But Wells Fargo sold the loan to Goldman Sachs. Goldman then bundled it with nearly 3,000 other loans and sold off that package of loans to investors as a mortgage-backed security. It kept Wells Fargo on to collect payments from homeowners.
There are too many people stirring the pie, so you don't know who to really go to. We thought it was just with Wells Fargo. Now I'm saying, who is these investors?
Who are the investors who bought the mortgage security? Wells Fargo told me that's confidential. Typically, they're institutions like pension funds or hedge funds, maybe your 401k. I've talked with lots of homeowners, and many say they've been told they can't get a modification because an investor won't allow it. But experts say that doesn't make sense. That's because investors don't decide what loans to modify. Bill Frey works with investors who buy these mortgage-backed securities.
The investors have no direct involvement in it and have no legal say in the modifications that are allowed.
That's the job of servicers like Wells Fargo. They're the banks that process your monthly payments.
It's really the servicer that takes the very active role of collecting the payments and determining whether to foreclose or not.
Kurt Eggert is a law professor at Chapman University. He says the Making Home Affordable program requires servicers to help any homeowner who qualifies. The only exception is if a contract with investors prohibits it. See, these contracts say what servicers can and can't do, and they usually allow modifications. But the problem is, many contracts are so vague, it gives investors wiggle room to sue if they don't want to modify loans.
It causes the servicer to want to watch their back more.
And watching their back often means doing little or nothing. There are three ways a bank can modify a loan. They can lower your interest rate, they can reduce how much you owe, or they can add extra years at the end of your loan. In the Harris's case, Wells Fargo offered to drop their rate to a little over 4%, a big drop. But Steve Crum, the Harris's lawyer, says the monthly payment would still be almost $300 more than the Making Home Affordable program requires. That's because Wells Fargo insists on increasing the amount of the loan.
What Wells Fargo is proposing to do is to say that they can modify the loan based on the principal balance, in addition to unpaid fees, accrued interest, late fees, and numerous other fees.
That means the Harris's $235,000 loan would grow by an extra $80,000. Wells Fargo told me that's the best deal the investors will allow. So I looked at the contract that Wells Fargo has with the investors, and it doesn't require the bank to add in all that overdue debt. It actually says Wells Fargo can change any term of the loan. I repeatedly asked Wells Fargo for an explanation. It wouldn't answer my questions. The bank would only say that it considered the new monthly payment to be reasonable. Barbara Harris says she simply can't afford it.
I would be very lost without my home. And I do believe that the president have made it possible for someone in this situation like my husband and I to be reprieved and helped.
The Harrises wish they could turn back the clock, because back when they refinanced, they could have qualified for a government loan, or probably even a prime loan. But instead, their broker talked them into a subprime loan, and the Harrises became yet one more family caught in a mortgage-backed security. In Atlanta, Georgia, I'm Karen Wise for Marketplace.
ProPublica has an online graphic showing the relationship between all the companies that have a say in the Harris's loan. You can find that link on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, next time you plop yourself down in your favorite neighborhood coffee shop looking for free Wi-Fi, get ready to actually buy a cup of coffee or something, will you? The Wall Street Journal has a trend piece today. Both big national chains and local moms and pops are getting tired of internet freeloaders. You know the type, the ones who come in, grab all the comfortable chairs, open their laptops, and don't get up for hours, not even to buy a muffin. Owners are covering up electrical outlets and posting signs to discourage all the hangers-on. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Hangers-on welcome here, by the way. Today, the Dow dropped 24 points, a quarter of 1%. The Nasdaq lost 19 points, 1%. The S&P 500 fell 5 points, about a half percent. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, paying for a taste of American aristocracy.
There's certainly no way I would ever have walked the halls with the Vanderbilts. So to hear the other side was very interesting for me.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.